Affairs. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Alternate Show with Trevor Thomas.
Hi there. My name is Trevor Thomas, and you're tuned to KSKQ.org 94.9 FM. Thank you for listening to my show. If you're new, this is a variety show that includes music, old-time radio shows, thought-provoking conversations, metaphysical discourses, skits, news, and more. Coming up this hour, we'll be playing music from The Postal Service, Daft Punk, Tegan and Sarah, The Flaming Lips, and Marina and the Diamonds. We'll also do an episode continuing where we left off on the old-time radio show The Shadow. And in a few minutes, we'll be talking about The Ghost in the Machine, which is our topic for this week's show. But first, this is Machine in the Ghost by The Faint.
There's no ghost in this machine. I make my own mistakes. We seem like skeletons with bonehead beliefs. History's been crucified. Humans supernaturalized. We hope we're not alone. Exploded stars in space debris taught itself to make some things. Echoes set off what was there before the bang. How did nothing come to end at once? Let's ask the atheists. Let's ask the atheists. The astronauts, the mystics of the Amazon, the police, the cults, the witches, the Pope, the crystal ball, the fear of God, the tarot cards, the dowsing rod, theologians, alchemists, black magicians, physicists, say. Guys and dudes.
So the topic today is Ghost in the Machine, which is an interesting topic. And I'm going to be playing in the background some music from an album called Ghosts 1 through 4 by Nine Inch Nails, which I thought was slightly appropriate. So, here's the question. The topic Ghost in the Machine, what basically does that mean? There's a lot of different areas that that applies. There's a book that it was based off of. Let me see if I can find that. It's called, it's called Ghost in the Machine by British philosopher Gilbert Ryle. And it was his derogatory description of René Descartes' mind-body dualism, which is a mouthful. The idea being that there is, in a system where you have your mind and your body, there are sometimes actions that your mind takes that don't necessarily make sense, or that your body takes that don't make sense based on what you're doing consciously. And he attributes them to pre-existing programming or random bits of code that determine how your brain works, that you don't necessarily know what's happening or why it's happening that way. It's working in the background. It's something that maybe more primitive man had going on for them, like cavemen and things, more of our instinctive nature, the things that we do that we don't know that we're doing, the way that we react to certain things. Like if you suddenly saw a woolly mammoth, your first thought would be not, wow, a woolly mammoth, how out of place that is. It would be, oh my God, run. Because that's your instinct when seeing something like that is programmed into who you are, into how you've been evolved. There's a lot of things that aren't programmed, but it works with animals. You know, animals grow up instinctively knowing certain things, like when they see a rabbit, that's something they can eat. Right? If it's like a baby wolf or something, right? It's like, okay, a rabbit, go after that rabbit. But if they see like a moose, it's like, run away. It's all programming. How our mind works that runs in the background. But this is even more than that. This is like saying there are random bits of things that we do that we have no control over, nor do they necessarily make any sense in regards to how we were programmed. They just fit together. Like if you have one thing that says something, you have another thing that says something different. You put them together, they make something completely the opposite of what the two are. It's like chemistry. The point behind all of that is that, well, originally the book was basically talking about the idea of that mind-body dualism. You've got your body and your mind, and they don't necessarily act in accordance with each other. It says, to the concept of mind... Okay, so Ryle's book, Gilbert Ryle's, the guy who wrote this book, was called The Concept of Mind, and it introduced the idea of the ghost and machine to highlight the perceived absurdity of dualist systems like Descartes, where mental activity carries on in parallel to physical action. But, you know, I'm kind of reading it while I'm thinking about it. But where their means of interaction are unknown or at best speculative. There's a better description of that. Let's see. See if I can find this. No, I cannot find this. So we're just going to move on. So, okay. Ghost in the Machine. Really interesting concept. And it was also brought up in a movie, which I really like, called I, Robot. Which, of course, was a book originally. But the movie has a quote by the character that died. And this is basically that quote. There have always been ghosts in the machine. Random segments of code that have grouped together to form unexpected protocols. Unanticipated, these free radicals engender questions of free will, creativity, and even the nature of what we might call the soul. Why is it that when some robots are left alone in darkness, they will seek out the light? Why is it that when robots are stored in empty space, they will group together rather than being alone? How do we explain this behavior? Random segments of code, or is it something more? When does a perceptual schematic become consciousness? When does a difference engine become the search for truth? When does a personality simulation become the bitter moat of the soul? And that's basically what today's topic is. What's the difference between a series of random codes, programming that basically decides who and what something is and does. You know, AI, artificial intelligence, versus consciousness, versus your mind, versus your soul. What's the difference between us and a computer? What's the difference between us and a wolf or some other animal? You know, where do we draw that line between consciousness and rote behavior or pre-programming? A lot of people believe there is no difference, that you can just take somebody's mind, and if you knew how to copy every aspect of it, you could plug it into a computer. You would live in that simulation. You would basically be just the same as you are now, but as a series of ones and zeros instead of, you know, biological ones and zeros, basically. Because honestly, what's the difference? Our body runs in basically the same way a computer does. There's electrical impulses that go into our brain that trigger different things. Synapses, you know, are, in fact, computers were based on how a mind works. You've got your RAM, which is your conscious memory. You've got your hard drive, which is more of your subconscious memory that you can access whenever you need to. You've got your graphics card, audio card, all those different pieces that make things work the way they need to. You've got your processor, which is your brain. It's the thing that does things actively. Your output devices, your input devices, those are your five senses, your fingers, your hands, the things that you do, all that kind of stuff. Computer was based on a brain, on how a brain works, on how people work, which I think is really interesting. So is it possible to just take your brain and upload it into a computer? And how many movies out there deal with that idea? Tron, for one, which is coming out again very soon. Avatar. That's a really interesting one. And it's not necessarily downloading your brain. It's more downloading your soul, which was, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's possible. You know, they connected two people to a tree, and those two people kind of transferred their consciousness from one body to another, almost. It's like this tree was the lifeline. In many ways, it was a biological computer. And such things do exist. I mean, there's a grove of trees somewhere that are connected together that kind of form a unique bodily consciousness. I guess they're able to communicate with each other. They're basically one giant tree underground, kind of. All the roots connect, and you can't tell one tree from the other, but it's a network. It's like the ideas from the movie Avatar, a network of trees and life and all that kind of stuff. So what's the difference between that and the computers that we have right now? Faxing and scanning and copying things. Well, one difference is that as people, as far as I can tell, every person is truly unique. There's a couple movies that deal with that idea too, or TV shows. Battlestar Galactica, which I really like, is a show that deals with the idea of a series of clones that were, you know, copies of each other. When they die, they kind of upload into a new body. But as they grow, they differ from each other. So they may have started out all the same, but as they have learned and had different experiences, they've grown into unique individuals. They can't necessarily come back together again. They could. They could, like, merge their consciousnesses, but they would have different ideas. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sort of a battle of wills, you know. You degenerate into kind of a war zone in your mind. So, got a little off topic there. But the idea behind this, basically, Ghost in the Machine, the idea that you can copy yourself, you can become part of something that's different, something that is intangible, is in many ways kind of a metaphysical or spiritual or religious concept. You know, copy yourself a new machine, become one with the machine. You know, there's a lot of people out there that believe that computers will achieve consciousness fairly soon here. I mean, we've seen Terminator, we've seen some of those other movies. It may not be good consciousness. There's an anime series called Ghost in the Shell, which deals with that a lot. Some people believe machines already have achieved consciousness. I mean, what's your definition of consciousness? And that's really the question. Like, think about the internet, for one. The internet is a series of computers connected together. Random bits of information go all over the place. But in terms of an entity, we have no idea how it works. Well, you know, we've got basics, but if you're going to track all the information that goes around the internet, you would find patterns. You would find things that fit together, but you wouldn't be able to track all of it. There's just way too much information. It's a complex system that has its own rules that we're just beginning to understand. Now, these rules evolve and change as we add computers or add different kind of things or new stuff comes up like Twitter and Facebook and all these different ideas. But if you think about it, with the amount of complexity that is involved in the internet, the amount of stuff that goes back and forth, the patterns, the random bits of code that fit together to create unexpected protocols, how do we know that the internet hasn't already achieved this consciousness that we're talking about? How do we know the internet isn't an entity in and of itself? I mean, it might not be an entity like you or I, but maybe it's more like a plant. It just sort of grows, it reacts and responds, has its own ideas about, well, not ideas. You know, it has its own programming about where it's supposed to go, about how things work. It's evolving and creating itself to some degree. The internet, is it an entity? I don't know. Maybe. But that really begs the question of what is the difference between something that's alive and something that's dead? I mean, how do you tell? Like, you've got all these different definitions for life. Well, what is life, basically? And can you copy it? There's this really great book that I read. It has the idea that there's these... they're like carpets, I guess. They're giant one-celled organisms, basically, that cover an entire planet. And the idea was that these things, they connect together in a lot of different ways. They die off, they new ones grow, they split. They're basically single-celled organisms that reproduce asexually, covering this entire planet, giant single-celled organisms. But when they took the data of how these things grow and connect together, it was such a complex amount of information because it was spread out over this whole thing. You take all this data and you realize it's got a plan, it's got something going on. There's things that happen unpredictably in that. And when they strung it through a computer in a particular way, they actually came out with a simulated world that existed completely outside of this plane. It was like taking the data that you see in these single-celled organisms and translating it into something else, and suddenly you've got a video game or a virtual world that doesn't exist anywhere else. It's like, just by looking at different things, translating the information you see around you, maybe you come up with whole different worlds. I mean, supposedly there's like 99.9% of empty space around us. So what fills that space? Maybe entire other planets on different dimensions or in alternate realities, filling the same space, but just on a completely different wavelength that we can't see in this reality. You know, you've got your third dimension, you've got your second dimension, you've got your fourth dimension. As a third dimension, we can't see what's going on in a fourth dimension or a fifth dimension. But that doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't exist. We've got all these different ideas about how the world works. You know, I mean, how do you know this stuff isn't happening all around us all the time? How do you define life? Is a rock life? It evolves over time. How do you decide what gets lost in translation? And I guess that would be the question, is when you're deciding what's in a program, if you're going to put yourself into that program, then what comes with you? What's the piece of you that goes over there? What's the piece of you that gets left behind? There's a lot of people nowadays that are really trying to deal with, like, biological and genetic modification, right? The idea that we can make ourselves better as people by fixing aspects of ourselves that just nature got wrong. How do you know nature got that wrong? I mean, how do we know that much about ourselves? We're just beginning to understand how our brain works. We have all these ideas about how things work that, you know, they're theories that have been proven and disproven, and some of them, you know, have been proven so far, basically. But how do we know that it holds up in terms of who we really are? Are we really just this 3D body? Are we this brain? Are we this mind? Is there a soul? Is there consciousness? Do we extend out into other dimensions? Are there aspects of ourselves that we have no idea how they work or why they work, but dictate who we are and how we work? Are we just protrusions of our true selves from a completely different dimension into this one. You know, like maybe everything that we see ourselves as right now is just the pinky of this giant other being in a completely different universe. And the only thing that we see is that piece of us that protrudes in ours, that tiny tip of the pinky that is everything that we know ourselves to be. So now here we are taking that pinky, that sliver off the end of it, and copying it and saying, wow, I've just copied my whole self into a computer, into an AI. I'm creating other versions of this tiny sliver of a pinky. But what happens when you remove a piece of skin from yourself? It slowly starts dying and decomposing because it's missing pieces of how it works. Right? Our skin doesn't just exist by itself. It exists because it's part of a larger whole, a larger biological mechanism that makes no sense to it in and of itself. Say you're a fly sitting on a computer or a telephone or something like that. Your field of vision is such that this giant world stretches out in front of you, but that entire world to us is the handle of a telephone. It can't even see you from where it is. Even if you're looking straight on it, you're so huge to this fly that it doesn't see you as an object, it sees you as a planet. It's just perspective. Right, to us, it's this tiny little fly. To it, we're an entire universe. Maybe a fly isn't the best example. Maybe like a tick or a mite or like something really microscopic. So, coming back to the idea of losing a piece of yourself in the process. Yeah, basically, how do we know how much of ourselves is ourselves? How do we know what we lose? There's a book that got turned into a movie by Michael Crichton called Timeline. It was a really bad movie, but the idea was that you can move through time, transport yourself through time by faxing yourself, basically. The technology was based on faxing. It's almost like sending a copy of yourself back into the past. And the problem came up that if you fax yourself too many times, there starts to be errors in the code. But that's really the issue, is that, you know, those errors in the code become a part of who that thing is. If you're making a copy of yourself, you're, you know, creating a piece of yourself based on based on a snapshot of who you are at this very second. It brings in nothing of who you are, who you were, or the evolution of the planet, or, you know, the evolution of your race, or any of that stuff. None of that is part of that copy. It's just a copy. Continues on as it is. Sort of like the question of digital versus analog. I mean, how much do we lose when we are looking at a copy of something? Let's say you're recording something and you put it on I can't even remember what they're called, a record, of course. A record versus an MP3. How much do we lose? We think we lose nothing. I mean, nowadays everyone listens to MP3s. There's all these hardcore people out there that think the quality is infinitely better on a record than an MP3. So here we are as a society getting to the point where, in terms of technology, we can really do damage to ourselves. And that's really the issue that I'm thinking about here, is that the more changes we make, the more we limit ourselves as a people. You know, we can change our genes at birth so that we are predisposed towards certain things. You know, we look better, we have less health problems, things like that. But by doing that, you're almost working yourself into a genetic cul-de-sac, because we don't know what we're messing with. You don't know what you lose when you copy a piece of yourself, when you put a piece of yourself into a computer. But really, the question is, what does the computer have that we don't? I mean, where do we determine life? Like, I would think that if I was to copy myself into a computer, if that was possible at this point, then that piece of myself would have kind of a life in and of itself. It wouldn't be me. It wouldn't be as complex as me. It would be a different version of me. It would be like a two-dimensional version of me. It could never replace me. It would be unique in and of itself, have its own whatever. And it may evolve on its own to be something incredibly complex and unique. But I don't think you can just copy a piece of yourself and say, all right, I'm done with myself now. This will be now be me. I don't think that's how it works. I mean, it's the question of what happens to you when you die, you know? Is there a soul, really? So I'm starting to run out of time here, but there's one last thing that I wanted to throw out there. And that is that there was an experiment that was done to determine whether or not the soul exists. And it was a man that was getting close to dying. He put himself on a scale that he kind of built for himself. That it was a very precise scale, because he wanted to see what the difference was between someone who was alive and someone who was dead, and if there was any actual physical difference between the two. So what he did was he weighed himself beforehand, and then I think he gave himself like a lethal injection or something like that. And then he had the machine weigh himself after he was dead. I'm pretty sure there were other people involved in this experiment as well. He didn't just leave that for the cops to find or anything. But the difference, apparently, was 21 grams. So nowadays, people say that's how much a soul weighs, because that's what you lose when you die. As far as I can tell, there's no other logical explanation for where that weight goes. I mean, it's not like when you're breathing, you weigh more than when you're not. There was just suddenly a weight that was gone. It was like he stopped breathing, and then suddenly he weighed 21 grams less. Like, what happened? Where did that go? So maybe that's what the soul is.
Constipation can be a problem for anyone, even doctors. And when constipation occurs, it's interesting to see just what doctors consider important about a laxative they might use or recommend. Well, a majority of the doctors we heard from had this to say.
A laxative should be effective, gentle, close to natural acting. A medicine that can be used with complete confidence.
Now, X-Lax has been popular with many doctors and millions of people over the years because chocolated X-Lax is effective. Overnight, it helps you toward your normal regularity. X-Lax is so gentle, so close to natural acting, there's no upset. That's why many doctors and millions of people use X-Lax with complete confidence. X-Lax, the laxative that helps you toward your normal regularity, gently, overnight.
Southern Oregon Jobs with Justice proudly supports KSKQ LP 94.9 FM in Ashland, Oregon. Southern Oregon Jobs with Justice brings together labor unions, religious congregations, student groups, and community organizations to improve working people's standard of living, job security, and their right to organize. Visit their website at www.sojwj.org. KSKQ thanks Southern Oregon Jobs with Justice for supporting community radio. I have a message here for the community. The bicycle taxi in town, known as the Ashland Eco Cab, was stolen overnight from the outside the station on Hersey. The owner, Marco, is asking for help locating it. If you've seen it today or know of anyone who has it, please call the Ashland Police or 227-8887.
You're listening to KSKQ.org 94.9 FM, Ashland Community Radio.
And now, irrelevant news with Trevor Torres.
Thank you. Our top story today, Argentinian convicts who escaped from jail reportedly evaded capture by disguising themselves as sheep. Maximiliano Periana and Ariel Diaz dressed in full sheepskin fleeces with realistic-looking heads as they tried to evade capture. They were wearing gray clothes but had full sheepskins, including the sheep's heads over their heads and back, said a farm worker at La Almeida. They were found hiding amongst a herd of thousands of sheep. In Cambridge University, students are being offered pole dancing classes to help relieve summer exam stress. Lessons will take place in the Blue Room of the Union Building, better known as the venue for debates among the likes of Sir Winston Churchill, the Dalai Lama, and former Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Warehouse staff at Carlsberg are on strike in protest at the community decision to limit beer drinking at work to lunch breaks. The Denmark workers say they should be able to have 3 beers a day on top of any they consume during lunch. Danny Ham earned the honorary title this month by getting the most votes from regulars at the Story Inn, a restaurant and bar about 15 miles east of Bloomington, where she's a bartender. How'd she get the award? She accidentally lit her heavily hairsprayed hair while smoking a cigarette. She heard a whoosh and found her hair afire while driving. She escaped serious injury. And now some useless trivia. The brightest star in the constellation Leo is Regulus. John Pemberton, an Atlanta druggist, has been credited as the original creator of Coca-Cola. Over the years, the recipe was altered slightly, but by the time he died in 1888, it had never really taken off. It is rumored hot chocolate was a favorite of Aztec Emperor Montezuma, and that he drank 50 golden goblets every day.
This has been Irrelevant News with Trevor Thomas.
And now for something completely different.
So I'm going to do the show, The Shadow, picking up where we left off, which was about 13 minutes into the last episode, just a little bit before the halfway break. This is The Man Who Murdered Time, a new Shadow episode from a new serial by The Shadow, of The Shadow. Here we go. Give me a second to set this up.
Lamarck, you remember the Higgins, don't you?
Father.
Yes, that's the family.
Father,
well, they're very
Father,
anxious that
me.
You and I go south.
Father,
what am I saying? What happened? Oh, Lamarck, you're holding me again.
Margot, the instant you let go of me, you said exactly what you said 24 hours before. When I grabbed you, you snapped back, free of the new time spell.
Then it's true. Oh, Lamarck, I'm afraid. Don't let go of me.
Steady, Margot.
Oh, but it's horrible. People will go on living through December 31st to eternity, never knowing, never realizing. Lamarck, there'll never be a new year.
You're absolutely right. Unless this can be stopped.
But how can anyone stop it? Nothing human could have caused a thing like this to happen.
I'm not so sure, Margot. Hughes told me that a cousin of his, a brilliant scientist, claimed to have invented a time machine. That cousin of Hughes may be responsible for what's happened to time.
But who is this man? Where does he live?
Hughes didn't say. I'll have to find him some way. And when I do, Margot, it'll be as the shadow. Perhaps the shadow will be able to switch time back to normal. Bring the new year to a world doomed to live a day which never ends.
In just a minute, the curtain rises on Act Two of The Shadow's Adventure. Meanwhile, a word to you motorists. Do you slow down passing a school? Do you pass other cars on a hill? Do you come to a full stop at street intersection?
The shadow wonders. The terrific toll of deaths and injuries indicates that too many motorists fail to exercise caution, fail to consider the other fellow. Play safe. It pays.
And motorists, here's one thing more. If you only realized the importance that safe tires, too, play in safe motoring, you wouldn't hesitate a minute to put the new Goodrich Safety Silvertowns with the Lifesaver tread on your car. For remember, this new Silvertown is much more than a new tire. It's a new kind of tire safety. On the inside, it has the famous blowout protection of the Goodrich Golden Fly. And on the outside, it has the amazing new Lifesaver tread. The tread that sweeps wet roads so dry, you can actually light a match on its track. Yes, sir, that's plenty dry. So it's hardly surprising that Silvertowns will give you the quickest non-skid stops you've ever had.
Margot, keep holding on to me.
I will, Lamarck. We can walk. My apartment isn't far. Oh, why don't you let me come with you?
No, Margot. This is the shadow's job. Maybe dangerous. I want you to be safe.
Safe in a world gone mad? Oh.
Come, watch yourself. The streets are slippery with ice. Here, hold on to me more tightly. We'll cross here. Remember, Margot, last night, on this very spot?
Same taxi, the same corner, same poor woman struck down. It's happened all over again.
Yes, Margot, and it'll happen all over again every 24 hours, from now until doomsday.
Oh, it's frightening. Think of that woman over and over.
Unless I can put time back on its track, Margot. I must. Let's hurry.
Oh, look at that poor man shivering in the doorway there. He hasn't even an overcoat.
He looks hungry, poor devil. Margot. Remember last night? In a moment, he'll step out of that doorway and ask me for a dime.
Excuse me, mister. Could you give me a dime for a cup of coffee? I'm so cold, I'm freezing. Oh, thanks. Thanks, mister.
There's one thing I'm glad of, Lamarck. He doesn't know. He doesn't know he's doomed to shiver and freeze and starve like that forever. And millions like him. Millions of unfortunate shivering and starving all over the world tonight.
That machine. I must find that machine. Well, here we are, Margot.
Don't bother to take me up. There's so much for you to do. So much, Lamarck. The doorman will let me in. It's exactly the same time we got home last night.
Good evening, Miss Lane. Bad night, ain't it?
Hurry, Lamarck. Find Hughes's cousin.
Since time's repeating himself.
Well, I always say when
Hughes will meet me in the afternoon at my club. Just as he met me yesterday. We'll talk as we talk then. Perhaps he'd be able to tell me.
Lamont, what's the matter? You're so pale suddenly.
It's funny. I felt weak just then. As if my strength, the strength of my will were fading away. Could it be that
Lamont,
I too...
You mustn't. You've got to be strong. The world needs your strength.
Let go of me, Margot.
All right.
You're draining my power, my strength away. Let go.
The wind is very biting, Miss Lane.
Yes, it is. Fred, will you take me up to my apartment?
Yes, sure, Miss Lane.
Gone. Safe upstairs. Goodbye, Margot. Until tomorrow. Tomorrow ever comes.
Mr. Craig, on behalf of all the employees of the club, I wish to thank you for your generous
Stuart,
New Year's gift to the
listen
personnel.
Listen to me. Can't you hear? Don't you
the
understand what I'm saying
to you? And may I thank you, too, Mr. Hughes, for your gift.
You're
welcome, Stuart. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Stuart, stop.
I wish I could have made it more, Cranston, but it hasn't been a terribly good year for
Hughes,
me.
Let me take your hand. You're merely repeating what you said 24 hours ago.
Fully, though
listen to me.
The face you made for a lot of it.
Who is your cousin?
That's why
who
I'm
is
looking
he?
Forward
does he
to
live?
The New Year so eagerly.
Oh, hopeless. He's not attuned to my will. I'll have to follow him. Make him lead me to this cousin of his.
Expect to be out of death very shortly.
I must concentrate. My willpower seems to be failing. I must hold on until Hughes visits his cousin.
Convinced, Hughes?
Can't be. It's impossible, Willard. It's a trick, a dream, a nightmare.
You'll be saying that for all eternity.
I'm getting out of here.
Are you, cousin? Try to, if you can.
I can't. I'm paralyzed. I can't get out of this chair.
Hughes, you can. You're not paralyzed.
Now,
yes.
Don't you, Hughes?
Yes, horrible pain.
Hughes, there is no pain.
You shouldn't have drunk.
You scare me.
Your glass contained slow poison.
No! No, help! Help!
I have helped you, Hughes. You are not poisoned. I substituted this antidote for the poison in the glass of sherry Willard handed you. You're not poisoned, I tell you. Exert your will, attune it to mine. Try to get out of that chair. Hold me. Hold me. Now try. I've broken the grip on the time spell a little. I made something happen that didn't happen yesterday. You did something just now you didn't do then. You drank the antidote instead of the poison. Try. Try yours.
I heard a voice. A voice. But there's no one here. No one but... Try. Try it, then. Chair. Out the chair. I'm standing! I'm free! Free!
Thank the Lord. Hughes, can you hear me now?
Who are you? Who are you? I see only Willard. I don't think he sees me. I feel someone holding me. Who are you?
Never mind who I am, Hughes. Get out of this house at once. Go to the home of your friend, Lamont Cranston.
Yes, yes.
You are to attend the New Year's Eve party there. Yes. Remember?
Yes, yes. I seem to remember.
Go now, Hughes. You don't need me to hold you now. I will you to go.
A little while now, sir. It's almost midnight. You'll die just before midnight.
I'm Jefferson Zuma. You are listening to Chaos.
Who is that?
You feel my power now, Willard. I'm holding you fast. Fast, do you hear? My will. Submit to my will. It dominates you. Snatches you from the field of that evil time spell you cast over the world.
I'm powerless in the grip of some invisible force. And it speaks. Who are you? Who?
I am the Shadow.
The Shadow?
Dr. Willard.
Of Soma.
You are guilty of the greatest crime ever perpetrated against mankind. You thought to condemn the rest of the world to cold and darkness and suffering.
No, no, I didn't mean to do that.
You wanted an eternal life of pleasure, of evil. You tried to stave off forever the death that hung over you like a sword.
I don't want
to
die.
To satisfy your selfishness, you tried to, you did, break the laws of nature. And so you must be punished, Dr. Willard.
Punished? Oh.
In a moment, I shall smash your devilish time machine, reduce it to splinters and scrap. And the instant the machine is smashed, time will snap back to normal. Instantaneously, time will take up where it left off when you put the machine into operation. And so will come what you thought to destroy forever. The new year. The blessed new year. That means new hope and happiness for the good and the innocent people of the world.
smash the machines. Give me one more day of life, just one, and I'll smash it myself.
Not 1 hour, not one minute, not 1 second.
Don't let me die! Stop!
I don't know what happened to me. I feel as if I just woke up from a bad dream. I found myself running up here.
Mr. Hughes, you're ill.
No, he's all right, Margot. You are all right, aren't you, Hughes?
I guess I am. What time is it?
It's just past 12 o'clock, Mr. Hughes. Happy New Year.
New Year? Yes, yes. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year, Hughes. Happy New Year.
As a matter of fact, Lamont, it seems to me I had a dream, too. The strangest sort of dream.
Perhaps you did, Margot.
Well, anyway, Happy New Year, Lamont.
Happy New Year.
Guess what? I'm not in love. favorite answering machine messages.
Okay, well, finally got this answering machine. Now, how does this thing work? Okay, press the record button. Okay, I did that. The light should be on. Wonder why it's not working right. I wonder what this button does.
As you can see, we're not at home. Or else we would have got the phone. Please leave your message at the tone.
Well, we're almost at the end of our show. Thank God, right? Now, the shadow was fun, at least. But before we go, get out a pen and paper. It's time for Spell Speak.
Spell Speak.
Okay, if you can keep up, you will be able to decipher this very important message. Once you're done, be the first to email me this message at trevor@kskq.org, and you'll get a prize. If you need to hear it again, the show will be up in the archive section at kskq.org later tonight. Here we go. HEWHOSTANDSONTOILETISHIGHONPOT. After the closing, we'll be playing Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, Part 1, by the Flaming Lips. Coming up at 8 is some sort of random playlist. And thank you for listening to my show. If you have feedback or suggestions, which I imagine at this point you will, or just want to say hi, send me a message at trevor@kskq.org. Tune in again next Tuesday at 7 on kskq.org, 94.9 FM, when we'll be talking about something new and interesting. And the phone is ringing, so I'm going to go get that. Finally, here's the word brought to you by Sean Connery.
If there was any one thing I could say that really embodies my philosophy, it would be this. Love may not make the world go round, but I must admit that it makes the ride worthwhile. I like women. I don't understand them, but I like them. There are women who take it to the wire. That's what they're looking for, the ultimate confrontation. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong in hitting a woman, so I don't recommend you do it the same way that you hit a man.
You've been listening to The Alternative Show, which would not be possible without substantial donations from Anna Septic, created by Aaron Tyers, with producer Terry Plott, and studio engineers Ida Ho and Randy Peters. Special thanks to Howie Kisses, Ty Marks, and my good friend Richard Keed, patent lawyer Meg O'Tun, Mary Kay Cosmetics saleswoman Doris Close, and of course Al Gore for inventing the internet, without which this nearly live streaming broadcast would not be possible. All celebrity voices are impersonated unless stated otherwise during the show, which is broadcast live on location at Walt Disney's Tomorrowland theme park in Disneyland, France.
Où la piscine dans le Disneyland Resort, c'est plus beau, magnifique.
Featuring the host with the most, Trevor S. Thomas, and yours truly, Alan Wren. You're listening to KSKQ 94.9 FM, Ashland Radio, a product of the Multicultural Association of Oregon. Thank you and good night.
She has to discipline her body, because she knows that it's demanding to defeat the
Oregon.